You're listening to On the Same Page, a podcast from the Jefferson Madison Regional Library.
Welcome back to another episode of On the Same Page. We are your hosts. I'm Abby.
And I'm Katie. We're librarians at the Central Library.
On this episode, we hear from Monticello's Naya Bates about an event that took place at the Northside Library in January. It features a panel of descendants of families who were enslaved at Monticello.
But before we get to that, we've got book chat. All right, book chat. So Abby, what are you going to talk about?
I just read American Prison, A Reporter's Undercover Journey into the Business of Punishment by Shane Bauer. This was a very heavy read. Shane Bauer, about 10 years ago, was imprisoned in Iran with a couple of other journalists he was working with, and held there due to the journalism work that they were doing. And so now he works for Mother Jones, and so he was doing an investigative report and ended up writing an article, and then later writing this book where he went to work as a prison guard in a private for-profit prison. It was a state prison in Louisiana. Again, very dark, very heavy. But what he did that was really smart and that I really appreciated about it is he would trade off chapters between his experience as a prison guard. And you could see as his mentality shifted from like wanting to know more to like being in the guard, kind of like living as the guard, and his perception shifting. He was, you know, more angry at the inmates than he was at the system as he went on. But in between those chapters, he would have chapters that were just kind of tracing the history of prisons in the South, particularly, and the privatization of prisons. So he starts with emancipation at the end of the Civil War, and then immediately states began building like prison farms and plantations, and then that led to convict leasing, and then that just turned over to the privatization of prisons. So it's really an ugly history, and he doesn't shy away from that, but it was fascinating and very in-depth look into what life and a lot of times death looks like in a private run prison specifically. So
that's interesting.
Yeah, this one has been on my to read pile for about a year now, and I just couldn't bring myself to do it, but I'm glad I was finally able to dive in and get through it. It's easier, like, to actually, it's very readable, I guess. Okay. Just difficult content.
Yeah, the subject matter.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. What about you? What did you read?
Yeah, so I read an equally dark book, not quite so dark. It is Disappearing Earth by Julia Phillips. So there you go. That's all you need to know. It's literary fiction, and it's kind of a suspense book, but not kind of like you jump every time you hear a sound kind of thing, which I like because I am a baby when it comes to thrillers and suspense novels and movies. So this one, just to let you know, I will not be reading scary books. So this one, it takes place in Russia, in the, I'm going to try to pronounce this correctly, it's the Kamchatka Peninsula. Okay. So if you're looking at Russia, it's the far east little piece of land that sticks out.
Okay.
So it's a very isolated area. There's no major roads that connect it to the rest of Russia. It's basically like volcanoes and wildlife, and there's a lot of indigenous communities that live there. Mm-hmm. But it's ever since the fall of the Soviet, you know, it's kind of been industrialized over time. But the author, Julia Phillips, she spent 2 years there as a Fulbright grantee.
Interesting.
Yeah, so she kind of knows mm-hmm. what she's talking about, and it comes across really well in her writing. But the premise of the book is two young girls are out, and they're abducted by this stranger. We don't know who it is, but the first scene is, yeah, they're taken away.
Okay.
And then what follows is the year after that abduction. And it's kind of a cool premise where it's sort of like short stories. Like, each month is a different character in the town, and they're all related in some way. And it's all women. You get their perspective. So it's like...
Interesting.
Yeah, so it's... The mother of the young girl's missing, of course. She's in there, but they get like the wife of the detective, and there's, you know, like 6 degrees of separation between these, and it all comes together at the end. in a really cool way.
Cool.
Yeah, so really good writing, I found. And, you know, a little bit dark, obviously, the story, the main story of the abduction. But you see the inner lives of all these women and what they go through, like, you know, abuse in the relationships, physical, psychological abuse. But she goes into, like, the different indigenous tribes in the area and how there's, you know, prejudice against, like, the white-ish Russian settlers, prejudice against these indigenous communities.
That's often the story.
Yeah, so really fascinating. It makes me want to learn more about that culture.
And
yeah,
that's very cool. Good. I am intrigued.
Yeah.
Next, we hear from Monticello's Naya Bates about an event that took place at the Northside Library in January. In it, she discusses a particularly dark day in Monticello's and Central Virginia's history, the day of a major sale of enslaved people following Thomas Jefferson's death. She also quotes from a panel of descendants of families enslaved at Monticello, all of whom appeared at the event at the Northside Library. In mid-January, the Northside Library held a program called Roots and Remembrance from the descendants of Monticello's enslaved families. This event allowed descendants of people enslaved at Monticello to reflect upon and remember their ancestors. Joining us today to provide insight into this event is Naya Bates, who works at Monticello as the Director of African American History in the Getting Word Oral History Project. She was instrumental in organizing and presenting this event, so we are pleased to have her on the podcast today. Welcome, Naya.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you for being here. We're just going to let you kind of jump in with your introduction that you gave at this event, and then we'll follow up. I know you've got some quotes from panelists that they gave during the event, so we'd really like to hear those too, but we'll just start with the introduction.
Awesome. Yeah, I started by introducing our panelists at the event, but then I thought it was important because there were so many people there. I mean, it was standing room only, a little over 130 people, and I started by welcoming everyone, but also acknowledging that the moment that we are there to commemorate, or we're there to commemorate, was probably one of the darkest moments in Monticello's history. The event that we were commemorating was the anniversary of the first of several dispersal sales of enslaved people at Monticello after Thomas Jefferson's death. So we're talking about a moment where men, women, and children were sold, sometimes to other relatives of Thomas Jefferson, but also to professors at the University of Virginia and to slave traders throughout the American South. And so our goal in commemorating that anniversary was to acknowledge the impact it had on these families. So it was really special to have seven panelists there who were willing to share their stories and think about what that moment meant. So I started by giving that general welcome, and then the following excerpt that I'll read is part of the talk that I gave to set up the conversation with descendants. I wanted to make sure that everyone had the same background information. In January 1827, the newspapers of Central Virginia carried an advertisement that began, "Executor sale will be sold on the 15th of January at Monticello, the whole of the resident of the personal estate of Thomas Jefferson. For 5 days, residents of Albemarle and surrounding counties flocked to the mountaintop to bid on 130 valuable Negroes, stock, crops, and household and kitchen furniture. Potential buyers included Thomas Jefferson's family and friends, professors from the recently opened University of Virginia, a man formerly enslaved at Monticello, and the free relatives of enslaved persons about to be sold. This sale tore apart families, separated husbands and wives, and parents and children, and created a diaspora of Monticello's enslaved community. At the time of his death, Jefferson owned approximately 200 individuals. Of the 130 offered for sale from the Monticello plantation in 1827 and 1829, the fates of 55 are unknown. A further 70 individuals were advertised for sale in 1827 from his Poplar Forest plantation near Lynchburg, Virginia, but no accounts or records from that sale exist today. The 1827 sale at Monticello was the largest of the efforts to settle Jefferson's estate and debts, but it wasn't the last. Over the next 4 years, in sale after sale, furnishings, books, paintings, land, and humans were offered for purchase. At least three other auctions appear to have been held by early 1829, two at Poplar Forest, Jefferson's plantation in Bedford County, Virginia, and one in downtown Charlottesville. Held at the Eagle Tavern, formerly Eagle Hotel, the 1829 sale is believed to be the largest sale of enslaved people ever held in Court Square. The 1829 Charlottesville auction alone raised $8,300 from the sale of 33 individuals. Finally, in 1831, Monticello and 500 surrounding acres sold for $7,500. That, just a fraction of his human property, raised more than the sale of his house and land speaks directly to the immense wealth these individuals represented at the time. According to one estimate, the enslaved men, women, and children who lived at Monticello represented 90% of the appraised value of Jefferson's Albemarle County properties. Right about now, you're doing the gross mental work of calculating a man's wealth or net worth based on the number of people he held in bondage. And now that I'm pointing it out, you're wondering how we got here. The impetus for the sales was simple. Jefferson's enormous debt, which had ballooned to $107,000, approximately $2 million in 2019, by the time of his death. Poor financial decisions, inadequate agricultural income, financial panic, and a lavish lifestyle led to this moment. As was customary at the time, Jefferson's debt became the responsibility of his heirs, and a living nightmare for the men, women, and children held in bondage who knew they would be sold to cover that debt. Israel Gillette Jefferson was 29 when he was sold at the 1829 sale at Eagle Tavern. He described Jefferson's death as, quote, "an affair of great moment and uncertainty to us slaves, for Mr. Jefferson provided for the freedom of 7 servants only," end quote. The people freed in Jefferson's will included Burl Colbert, Joseph Fawcett, John Hemings, and Jefferson's 2 youngest sons with Sally Hemings, Madison and Eston Hemings. Sally Hemings would eventually be given her time, or freed unofficially, after Jefferson's death. Their 2 oldest children, Beverly Hemings and daughter Harriet Hemings, had already been allowed to run away from Monticello to D.C., where they passed as white and severed all connections with their family. Israel Gillette's memoir continues, quote, "All the rest of us were sold from the auction block by order of Jefferson Randolph, his grandson and administrator," end quote. Peter Fawcett was also enslaved at Monticello at the time of the sale. He was 11 years old when he was sold in 1827. Peter, who was not yet old enough to have a trade, describes the moment he realized he was property that could be sold. He says, quote, "Sorrow came not only to the homes of 2 great men who had been such fast friends in life as Jefferson and Adams, but to the slaves of Thomas Jefferson. The story of my own life is like a fairy tale, and you would not believe me if I told you the scenes enacted during my life of slavery. It passes through my mind like a dream, born and reared as free, not knowing that I was a slave, then suddenly, at the death of Jefferson, put upon an auction block and sold to strangers. I then commenced an eventful life." An eventful life indeed. Most of the enslaved families of Monticello were scattered in many directions and separated, some for decades and often permanently, by distance, by freedom and bondage, and by color lines. Peter Fawcett's father, Joseph, was freed in Jefferson's will and planned to use the wages he earned as a blacksmith to reunite his family. However, he was still not legally free at the time of the 1827 sale. The task of bidding for Fawcett's family fell to Jesse Scott, the husband of Fawcett's free half-sister, Sarah Bell Scott. She was the daughter of Fawcett's mother, Mary Hemings Bell, and Thomas Bell, a white merchant in Charlottesville. Together, the Fawcett, Bell, and Scott families raised and borrowed money to buy their family members' freedom. Yet, in the end, they did not have enough money to get everyone. They were only able to buy Fawcett's wife, Edith, and their 2 youngest children. Over the next 23 years, Fawcett continued to work to buy and reunite his own family. Joseph Fawcett made an arrangement with his son Peter's new owner to buy him back once he raised the money. However, Peter Fawcett's new owner ultimately reneged on the deal, leaving Peter stuck in slavery in Virginia while his family moved to Ohio. Peter ultimately learned to read and used that skill to forge free passes for other enslaved people around him. He taught Berkeley Bullock, buried at Daughters of Zion Cemetery, how to read. Peter Fawcett attempted to run away on 2 occasions. After his second failed attempt in 1850, he was once again put up for sale and purchased at auction by family friends and moved to Ohio. He ultimately became one of Cincinnati's most prominent caterers, a conductor on the Underground Railroad, and a renowned Baptist minister. Thomas Jefferson's family was well aware of the effects a sale would have on the enslaved community. In 1822, in the years leading up to Jefferson's death, His daughter wrote to Nicholas Trist about a conversation she had with Thomas Jefferson Randolph about moving to a more profitable area with the enslaved community, believing that by moving to the Deep South to produce cotton, the family could make enough money to pay off the tremendous debts. Martha Jefferson Randolph writes, quote, "I mentioned to Jefferson your idea of removing the Negroes to a country where they would be so much more profitable. He assented at once to the advantage of such a step, but said that what I knew to be fact, his grandfather would never listen to it for a moment. Although moving them in a body would occasion little or no distress to them, not a tenth of a part of which a sale under the usual circumstances would," end quote. In 1824, an 1824 deed of trust between Thomas Mann Randolph and Thomas Jefferson Randolph, cousins, spells out in no uncertain terms the preferred way of handling debt. It says that in the event that the value of the advance, a sale or mortgage in this case, not be settled, then the executor of the agreement should advertise a sale for 6 consecutive weeks in a Richmond newspaper and, quote, "proceed to sell so much of the property above conveyed, taking care always to begin with the slaves and not sell any part of the land until all of the slaves are exhausted, as will fully satisfy and pay to the said," end quote. Peter Fawcett and Israel Gillette's Jefferson's reminiscences, published decades after the sales at Monticello, are vivid accounts of their lives during and after slavery. They are also one small window into the horror and devastation that was visited upon the hundreds of enslaved people that Jefferson owned at the time of his death. And that concluded my remarks at the opening of the event. I then invited people to join me in a moment of silence to reflect on the list of names that I provided of the 130 people we believe were sold in those Monticello dispersal sales. And then I ended on this quote from Peter Fawcett. Peter Fawcett says, "There was never such a time in Virginia as during the visit of General Lafayette. 2 years after this, Mr. Jefferson died. Then began our troubles. We were scattered all over the country, never to meet each other again until we meet in another world."
Thank you so much for sharing that with us twice now. I think it is very clearly a history that it's important for all of us in the area to know about and to consider, especially when things like Monticello are discussed or when we're just talking about history of the area. I think some of the darker moments are often kind of glossed over in favor of not having to kind of contemplate what they really mean.
Right, it's hard. I mean, even thinking of how we commemorate public space, mm-hmm. It's rare that we think of Court Square in terms of being a sale space, right, where families are sold. So I thought it was important to call out that potentially the largest sale of enslaved people to ever take place there was from Monticello, and it was the estate of Thomas Jefferson and the 33 families who were impacted by that sale.
Yeah, and we are recording this in our central library, so we are, you know, maybe a couple hundred feet from, maybe more than that. We're very nearby to where the slave auction block is, mm-hmm. is the marker is. So that happened very near to where we are today. And you also brought with you quotes from some of the panelists.
I did. You know, I really wish we had been able to record the panelists during the event. But as you can imagine, it's very personal for them to share their stories. And I asked the panelists if we could record, and there were members of that panel who requested not to be recorded.
Sure.
I did take notes during that portion of the presentation. So some of the quotes that I have are from different parts of the conversation. I would say a lot of these came from the Q&A.
Mm-hmm.
And some background there, my portion of the talk was about 15 minutes or so,
mm-hmm.
And the remaining hour and 15 minutes, people stayed to listen to descendants share their stories, talk about their Monticello ancestors, and really answer some tough questions. There was discussions about reparations.
Mm-hmm.
We talked about racial reconciliation and the legacies of slavery. We talked about the current environment in Charlottesville. So the quotes that I pulled are taken from different parts of this conversation. Mm-hmm. So I don't want them to seem like they all come from, you know, one speaker or one moment in the conversation. But I did go get permission from our descendants who are participants in the Getting Word Oral History Project to share these quotes, because some of them are really powerful quotes. Mm-hmm. So I will go ahead and share some of these, but I also would like to maybe provide context for some of them,
sure.
Just so you know where they fell in the conversation. So the quote I'll start with is from a descendant of the Hearn family at Monticello. Edith Hearn Fawcett was one of the cooks in the retirement era. And the Hearn family is large, and they remained local after the dispersal sale. And this descendant, Myra Anderson, gave us this quote here. "My ancestors survived, and I am here because they survived. I am here carrying on their legacy. I have nothing but gratitude for my ancestors." Which really speaks to why panelists wanted to share their stories and why we were having this moment. The next comes from a descendant of Israel Gillette Jefferson, who I quoted in the introduction, and her name was Miss Joan Burton. Her family has also remained local. And she says, quote, "I have a lot of mixed emotions about this. It's a slog looking for your family history in property records." I would say that quote was probably the most striking quote mm-hmm. of the whole event.
Sure.
There was a lot of dialogue at the time, and we were talking about some of the challenges that descendants face in reconnecting the dots mm-hmm. and finding their family history. And it was at this moment that Ms. Burton mentioned how difficult it is to look for people, to look for yeah. human stories in property records, to have to look in court records and real estate records and deeds and those sort of things. The next quote comes from Mr. Calvin Jefferson, who is a descendant of several Monticello families. He's a descendant of the Hemmings family through Elizabeth Hemmings and Betty Brown. He's a descendant of the Granger family, and he's descended from Jupiter Evans, who was Jefferson's manservant earliest on in Monticello history. Jupiter was also the stonemason who carved the columns on the front of the house, so extremely skilled. And Mr. Jefferson says, "When I come back here and meet other people," here being Monticello, "when I come back here and meet other people in the family, it's like I've known them forever. Those family connections are still there." In a similar vein, one of the descendants of Madison Hemmings, who is Sally Hemmings' son, one of her four children who lived with Thomas Jefferson, and she was talking about her family's unique history. So we listened to how difficult it has been for descendants in particular of the families that labored in the fields and did the manual work at Monticello to find their family history. But this descendant, Jacqueline Yurkoski, has a very different story. Her family was freed. And Madison Hemmings left a memoir very early on, 1873. So they've had their family history for generations, and they've had the privilege of not having to dig as deep or not having to fight as hard to have their family history. So she was thinking about, you know, the advantage that presented her family with, and she said, quote, "Being part of this process has truly made me appreciate and understand that this is part of the American experience." Another one from Miss Joan Burton. She says, quote, "I don't think the people who lived here through Jim Crow have any reason for shame, but I think it had an effect. It impacted their self-esteem." And that's Miss Burton speaking about the legacies of slavery and the impacts on the Black community in Charlottesville. And she was in conversation here with Jacqueline Yurkoski, and they're talking back and forth with each other kind of about these legacies and what it has meant for communities that are grappling with race and racial reconciliation. And Ms. Yurkoski responded, quote, "The responsibility does lie with the enslavers. Slavery was one mechanism for instilling fear and controlling people. Some of it still exists in other systems today. It straddles gender and racial lines. We should look for enslavers today and dismantle that." Really powerful quote from her. And then I'll end with a quote from Mr. Calvin Jefferson again. And he says, quote, "We need to have these discussions on how reparations and compensation for slavery now. We need to do it right now."
Thank you so much for those. That was somewhat speechless. Just hearing even kind of secondhand hearing quotes from descendants as they think about what the sale meant, very, very powerful. So thank you for taking such good notes to be able to share those with us and for
absolutely
really kind of making this happen.
Yeah, I mean, it was an emotional event. Yeah. You could feel it in the room. It was palpable that this history is still having a very real impact on these families. So I was just grateful that they were willing to share their stories. And hopefully we can do more conversations like that in the future.
Yes. And I'm grateful that you did it in one of our libraries in such a public forum. I think it helps us to kind of serve our community and kind of bring people together who aren't having these discussions or people who haven't been privy to the discussions that descendants might have
absolutely
in their own families and across families. So thank you
very it's very much for that. You know, it's very easy to read this history in books. It's easy to come to Monticello, see our exhibits, and associate that with a particular place. But it's another thing to think about the impact on a community of people, whether they remained nearby the plantation where they were enslaved, or whether their families ended up dispersed from those locations.
Right.
So I thought that was a key takeaway point. And for people who are not used to having these type of conversations, I think it was an opportunity to hear it firsthand and to not have to go do a bunch of research and figure out what you believe on that.
Right.
Right? You can hear it directly from the oral history of the families impacted by it.
I agree with all of that. Is there anything else that you want to share with us or our listeners about the event or about your work with descendants?
Yeah, I would like to share that we've been doing this work at Monticello since 1993, and our oral history archive continues to grow. We've interviewed a little over 200 people who were either direct descendants of people enslaved at Monticello or had direct knowledge of the families who were enslaved at Monticello. So if anyone out there believes that they had an ancestor who may have lived or worked at Monticello, and we interpret that pretty broadly. So if it's Monticello in Jefferson's lifetime or Monticello under subsequent owners, we would love to connect with you.
Great. And I will put links to all of the project websites and the contact information in our show notes. So thank you again so much for this. Before I let you go today, one of our favorite things to do is ask our guests what they've been reading or what they are reading that they'd like to share with us. And I know that yours will have a particular historical bent, so I'm looking forward to hearing what your answers are.
I'm reading so many things. Like, I have a lot of different books in progress. I recently finished The Water Dancer by Ta-Nehisi Coates, of course recommended by Oprah's book club. And it's great. I highly recommend it. If you're into futurism, time travel, the study of slavery, it's an interesting intersection of those things. And two books that I'm looking forward to reading that I have on my to-read pile next to the bed are Black Radical, The Life and Times of William Monroe Trotter by Carrie Greenidge. And I'm looking forward to A Black Woman's History of the United States, which is was released yesterday and is by Dana Ramey Berry and Callie Nicole Gross.
Wonderful. Thank you so much. I will also add those to our show notes. And
so that was a really moving look into an awful moment in our local history.
It really was. I know that when I was talking to Naya, I found it hard to kind of find the words to respond to the thoughts that she shared from the panelists. I was quite literally speechless.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah, it can be difficult to hear, but it's important history to know about for sure.
I agree. Thank you for listening to this episode. Please hit subscribe wherever it is that you are listening. And if you have books that you'd like us to read and discuss or topics that you'd like to hear on a future episode, please email us at podcast@jmrl.org.
That's all for us today. We'll be back in 2 weeks with another recording from a library event. Thanks for tuning in, and we're glad to be on the same page.